Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue. The $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and four-piece McNuggets. It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.
If you run a Shopify store, listen up. Shopify has got you covered for selling, but when your shipping volume grows and you're juggling multiple plugins just to get orders out the door, you need tools that can keep up. Stop duct taping your shipping workflow and use the tools that work better together, like Shopify and ShipStation. Think of ShipStation as Shopify's dedicated shipping partner. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels to save you time and money by automating the entire order fulfillment process, from syncing your orders all the way through inventory management and returns. Automate the rate browser to select the lowest rates on shipments, with discounts up to 90% off major carriers like USPS, UPS, and FedEx. No wonder businesses that use ShipStation grow 3 times faster on average and ship 15 times more orders. See how ShipStation can help you scale and boost your Shopify sales. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com.
Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue. The $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and four-piece McNuggets. It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.
If you run a Shopify store, listen up. Shopify has got you covered for selling, but when your shipping volume grows and you're juggling multiple plugins just to get orders out the door, you need tools that can keep up. Stop duct taping your shipping workflow and use the tools that work better together, like Shopify and ShipStation. Think of ShipStation as Shopify's dedicated shipping partner. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels to save you time and money by automating the entire order fulfillment process, from syncing your orders all the way through inventory management and returns. Automate the rate browser to select the lowest rates on shipments, with discounts up to 90% off major carriers like USPS, UPS, and FedEx. No wonder businesses that use ShipStation grow 3 times faster on average and ship 15 times more orders. See how ShipStation can help you scale and boost your Shopify sales. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com.
This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
Brian Walsh is on trial right now in Massachusetts for the murder of his wife, Anna, the mother of three who vanished on New Year's Day in 2023. Her body has never been found, but here's what makes this case legally fascinating. 2 weeks ago, right before jury selection, Walsh pled guilty to disposing of Anna's body and lying to police. He admitted that he dismembered her. He just says he didn't kill her. The defense is arguing Anna died suddenly in bed. No explanation, no cause, and no body. Walsh panicked. Meanwhile, prosecutors have internet searches from his laptop starting at 4:52 in the morning on the day she disappeared, including queries like best way to dispose of a body and research into a serial killer known as the Trash Bag Killer. Surprise! Trash bags are involved in this story, too. They also have a $2.7 million life insurance policy with Walsh as a sole beneficiary and evidence he knew his wife was having an affair. To break all this down, we're joined by defense attorney and former prosecutor Eric Faddis. The defense in this case has made some very bold choices here, arguably some of the boldest that we've seen. They had their client plead guilty to body disposal and obstruction right before trial, and now they're asking a jury to believe Anna Walsh just dropped dead for no reason, and her husband's only crime was a really bad cover-up. Eric, I want to start with the defense strategy here, because from the outside, this looks like a real high-wire act. Walk me through the decision to have Walsh plead guilty to the lesser charges right before trial. What's the tactical thinking here? Is this about limiting what evidence the jury sees, or is this something else?
You know, it's a little puzzling to me, Tony, but I think there are possible rationales. You know, one is, like you said, if he's already pled guilty to obstruction and to disposing of the body, his team might argue to the judge, hey, we don't need evidence of those issues. That those have been decided. The jury doesn't have to determine that. So it's not relevant. I'm not sure the judge is going to go along with that, but the judge might limit some of that evidence. Additionally, sometimes defense will sort of cop to what they can't deny. You know, the obstruction and the deception and then the cover up afterwards. Perhaps defense just thought, hey, those are too insurmountable. We need to come to this jury and say, hey, my client's taking responsibility for what he did, but he's not going to plead guilty to something he didn't do and he didn't kill her. I imagine that the defense will go something like that.
But how do you justify what he claims to have done with the body? I mean, that's like, where is she? How do you reconcile where is she?
You know, that's a tough one. I think his defense team is probably going to look at it and say, hey, he panicked. This was a chaotic situation. He didn't know what to do. And he knew that fingers might be pointed at him. You know, he is the spouse. That's the first person they look to when another spouse is missing or dead. And then on top of that, there was some infidelity allegedly going on. There were some marital issues. And I think defense is going to argue, hey, he thought all signs were going to point to him and he panicked and made a stupid decision, but that stupid decision wasn't killing her. I think it'll go something like that.
It's kind of like, he's a dumbass, but he's not quite that much. Right. Maybe he is. It's like, he's not a murderer. He's a dumbass, but he's not a murderer. It's basically the argument. They're arguing sudden, unexplained death, which it's not really a thing, but okay. And Anna just died in bed and Walsh found her. As a former prosecutor, how would you attack this theory? And also as a defense attorney, how do you sell it to a jury when the client then dismembered her?
Yeah, you know, from a prosecutorial perspective, you know, I think you look at it and you sort of convey to the jury that, hey, this guy's a liar. He's been lying since the beginning of this. And so now he's sort of contrived this fabricated defense of something that isn't really foundational in medical science, of unexplained death. That's not a thing, at least according to the prosecution. And so they're going to say, hey, look, this is a last-ditch Hail Mary to try to get out of this murder trial. You shouldn't believe him. On the defense side, I think they're going to say, hey, you know, unexplained weird medical stuff happens. And I think they have an expert, according to their opening statement, that might testify about that and to sort of say to the jury, hey, look, even though weird stuff does go down, that doesn't mean it's impossible. And if it's not impossible, is that some modicum of doubt? And is it sufficient doubt to acquit him? That's what the jury would say.
Is it possible but reasonable? That's what it's going to come down to. And those two things can be confusing to a jury sometimes, can they not? I mean, reasonable doubt is the bar here, or beyond a reasonable doubt is the bar here. But is this a reasonable, you know, expectation to think that a jury is going to buy this? Walsh is arguing that the defense attorney, Larry Tipton, is telling the jury that Walsh never thought anybody would believe that Anna was alive 1 minute and dead the next. So he's saying that he thinks that this, no one's going to buy this, even though it happened, no one's going to buy it. Is that actually a viable argument that an innocent man would choose dismemberment of his wife, this person he supposedly loves and cares about? The kids are in the next room eating McDonald's. Let's go chop up mom. I mean, overcalling 911. It's going to be the worst decision in the world. Really, they're trying to argue and make that this was some sort of real, legit reaction.
Yeah, some grisly circumstances for sure. And that reasonable piece is so critical, Tony, because they can't acquit just if there's any doubt. It has to be reasonable doubt. And the way I would address that as a prosecutor in trials is I would say, hey, let's say I told you that my name is Eric Faddis, and I had my mother come in here and she says, hey, I birthed Eric Faddis. And I show you my state-issued driver's license. I show you bank accounts. I show you all of this information. You know, is it possible that I hired some body double to come in and tell you that they're Eric Faddis? because I guess that's possible, but is that reasonable? And usually juries have a pretty good sense as to what's reasonable, what's not.
Would you as a prosecutor, would you sit with the jury and say, let's talk about the act of physically dismembering another human being? What would actually go into it? Would you maybe walk through that process to show how involved he had to be in this process? It wasn't that he just stuck her in a bag and took her outside. This took time. This took effort. He probably even broke a sweat. I mean, would you go through that kind of a thought process with the jury, or just let them imagine it?
Stacey, I would, in painstaking detail, go through every act and sub-act that had to be completed in order to accomplish what was accomplished here. And so, yeah, we're talking about, cutting into the flesh. We're talking about separating limbs. You have blood everywhere, presumably. And you have to then put it into bags. This is your partner. This is the person who is mothering your children. To just show how calculated and contemplative that must have been to go through that sort of undercuts this notion that it was just a freak panic and he didn't know what he was doing and he freaked out. It seems much more intentional and thoughtful than that.
The defense says experts are going to testify. Now, you just mentioned it too, that someone's going to come in and say this sudden unexplained death is real. What kind of expert testimony would it take, would you need to make this credible? And I'm wondering how difficult that can be without a body, without any medical evidence. I mean, the only thing that comes to mind, and Bob Mata brought it up on the show the other day, of his theory is they might go down the COVID route. The COVID card was found in the trash, so it shows she got a shot at some point. And that might not be a horrible route. We don't know that they're going to go down that route, but, there's been people that have claimed that they died or someone they know died. People have had things just after taking that shot, and they try to attribute it back to the shot. I don't know, how much medical research you have that can back something like that up, or even if they'd go down that route. But if you were defending this, would that be an angle that you might take when you literally have nothing to back up your claim?
You've got to look at all potential angles as defense on this one. And what we're talking about is cause of death. And so typically the type of expert you would get is a forensic pathologist who opines on cause of death. Now, they probably didn't conduct any examination of remains or anything like that. And also what they're going to be asserting is kind of almost like a non-occurrence, almost like I can't tell you what the condition is. I can't tell you what the circumstances were. It was nothing undetermined or unexplained. And I think it's going to be difficult for a jury if they want something to be able to hang their hat on in terms of reasonable doubt. And here, just saying, we've got no idea. How strong is that? I'm not sure how strong that is.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't feel strong, but you never know. I mean, no case is truly a slam dunk. Tipton, his attorney, has acknowledged in open court that his client, they're owning a lot of the BS here. They're owning it, saying, yeah, he lied to police in every single interview. Yes, he had the art fraud thing going on. That's made it into this trial. How do you rehabilitate a client's credibility who's basically known as a fraudster in the art world, a liar to the police, with a jury after conceding he's a liar? He's a liar, but we want you to believe this, the biggest bullshit story any of you have probably ever heard. But that's true. I mean, how do you go about that?
From the defense side, Tony, it's certainly tough, but I think you say, something like, he is a liar. You own it and you say, hey, he's admitted to it. He's pled guilty to deceiving police on this. He's a liar, but he's not on trial for lying. He's on trial for killing her. And if you don't have a cause of death and you don't have sort of surrounding circumstances, how can you convict on that? Just by saying, oh, this guy's deceptive, we can't believe what he's saying. Okay, that's fine, but the prosecution has to have a counter narrative, has to have evidence that counters that, that shows actually how the murder was committed, or at least that a murder was committed. And I think that's sort of the road you go down is, hey, you might think he's a scoundrel, but he's not on trial for being a scoundrel.
But why believe him about that if he's a liar in all these other aspects, how can you put that forth to a jury and go, well, believe him on this part. He didn't kill her. We have to believe him here. But everything else he does, well, that was bullshit because he's just a big liar and a scammer. So how do you convince them that, well, this is the one thing he didn't lie about, guys?
You know, certainly going to be a question in the juror's mind. And perhaps that is where the guilty pleas come in. Perhaps his defense gets up there and says, hey, this guy has a checkered background when it comes to veracity. But when it came down to it, right before this trial, he owned up. He took responsibility. Mm-hmm. He told you what he did. And you can believe him on those things. And he's made a change, and he's going to be truthful about, you know, he's not going to say he did something he didn't do. He's already caught to these serious things. And the reason he didn't cop to the murders is because he didn't do it. I think it goes something like that.
Dang.
The defense is they're pushing back on the affair motive. I know that's part of what the prosecution is pushing here, claiming that Walsh didn't know about Anna's relationship. I mean, it feels like they're going to be caught in a lie in the middle of saying we don't lie, even though we're a bunch of lying liars who've lied. Mm-hmm. Walsh didn't know about Anna's relationship with William Fasto. The problem with that, prosecutors say, is his phone search for Fasto's name on Christmas Day.
Oops.
Whoops. I mean, there's ways, I guess, you could argue that. I mean, you'd be curious. I think anyone would be, you know, your spouse is out working with somebody. Well, who is this person? You might, you know, do a little Google search. Just what? Let's look at their Facebook page. What are they up to? Who are they? Is that kind of what they're going to try and pitch to this jury, that he didn't know about this affair? Because you got that, and you also got the allegations that mom was hiring a PI to look into an affair. So there appears to be evidence that there's at least suspicion of an affair. How do you counter this as a defense attorney?
You know, if I'm defense, I'm saying, you know, is this suspicion or is this curiosity? Is it you know, wanting to know more about the people with whom your partner is associating and spending time? I suppose the same actions could have been taken if the female spouse was hanging out with another female colleague. It wouldn't be unusual for the male partner to that person and say, hey, my wife spent a lot of time with this gal and my wife is straight. But I want to know a little bit more. I think that's the horse the defense has got to ride, but that there is some evidence that sort of undercuts them.
Feels like a horse with a broken leg that's waiting for the glue factory. it just kind of seems like it's there. If you were defending Walsh, would you put him on the stand? He's the only person who can tell the jury what happened that night in a very convoluted case, but he's also a convicted fraudster who's already admitted to lying repeatedly.
This is a tough call, especially on this case, Tony, because the jury's going to have this cognitive dissonance in their head, right? They're going to say, hey, this guy admitted to covering up the whole thing and butchering his deceased wife's body. And on top of that, he lied to police about it. So what was going on? How can you make this make sense to where he didn't commit the murder, but he did all these other things? The way that you possibly make it make sense is you have the client get up there and explain. And the client would explain his side, his thought process, his rationale at the time. But that is, there are a ton of pitfalls there, including the acts of dishonesty, the prior fraud, and then the obstruction of justice, the deception to the police. I imagine he'd be cross-examined on those things. And so how believable is this guy going to be with that backdrop?
I think that's a big question. We really haven't seen him speak I can't think of any time I've seen him, other than just a few word answers in court, I haven't seen any examples of just how he is in public speaking. Obviously was able to defraud people out of money for the Andy Warhol of fake paintings and such, so he's got to, I would think, have somewhat of a silver tongue going on. But again, it's not something you can just go and say carte blanche, yes, you know, you're going to be great on the stand because you're the only one who can tell this story. It's very much going to depend on how good of a public speaker he's going to be. Judging by him so far, I don't know. I don't have a lot of faith. What's your read on the guy so far?
You know, sometimes when you have a client who is a little more sophisticated, who might be of a certain social strata or economic strata, sometimes they know how to make a decent impression. Sometimes they can talk, you know, especially if they're dealing with high dollar amounts and whatever they're doing, even if it's fraud, they can articulate, they can express themselves well, as opposed to someone who perhaps doesn't have that kind of background. And so that tends to lean in favor of it might make sense to call him to testify. But yeah, that being said, it's kind of a wild card in this because we haven't really heard much from him at all.
I just wonder if he is a smooth talker. If he could talk people into buying these fake Andy Warhols, maybe he's really charismatic. He's got the riz going on.
Smooth operator.
Yeah, exactly.
He's a smooth operator.
I just couldn't picture him in the music video. He doesn't seem like the person they'd cast for that role. I don't see it. Prosecutors are pushing for first-degree murder in the trial of Brian Walsh, which means they need to prove premeditation. They don't have a body, they don't have a cause of death, and they don't have a murder weapon. What they do have is a mountain of digital evidence, internet searches that read like a how-to guide for getting away with murder, and a defendant who is sitting on a $2.7 million insurance payout. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor with us, helping us break all this down. Eric, let's talk about what the Commonwealth is working with here. The internet searches are devastating on the stand. We've now heard, it started with publicly, we've heard like 20 or so of them over the last several years. There's hundreds of them. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is just like, oh my God, can you dig this hole any deeper? Best way to dispose of a body at 4:52 a.m. Hacksaw, best tool for dismembering. But the defense points out there were no such searches before January 1st. Does that help with the panic theory, or does the methodical nature of the searches over several days really undercut it?
It could cut both ways on that. You know, defense is going to look at that and also say there were these insurance policies, but I believe at least one of them was taken out in 2021. So it's not as if they were taken out weeks before this person died. This has been in place for a while, and that undercuts the allegation of motive. You know, on the prosecution side, they're going to say, look at these searches. Are you out of your mind? Like these show someone who had been thinking about these things. But the timeline is important on that. Additionally, the prosecution is probably going to point out, apparently Brian Walsh allegedly did some of the searches on his like kid's iPad. That shows a consciousness of guilt. That shows an attempt to conceal, an attempt to hide something. And so that timeline is going to be a factor for sure. And it'll depend on the jury, whether they sort of, reconstruct what was going on in this guy's head weeks prior, or if they say, hey, this appears to be a crazy event, spur of the moment, that happened that day.
But the thing is, I mean, some of these things, I mean, they've already admitted that, you know, yeah, he panicked, he did this. So if it's on the kid's iPad, this side doesn't, I mean, it kind of negates a lot of that with the fact that they've already admitted to that. One of the searches was for Patrick Kearney, the trash bag killer. I find this odd. Yeah. Prosecutors got that in over defense objections. How damning is it to the defense narrative that this was a spontaneous panic when he's literally Googling a known killer known as the trash bag killer and then proceeds to put Anna's remains and stuff into multiple trash bags?
Anytime you have a murder case, you never want searches on the client's phone of a serial killer. That's a horrible look, obviously. And then on top of that, the mode by which Brian Walsh, not allegedly, did dispose of the body appears to be a mode similar to what the serial killer used in his activities. And so clearly problematic there. You know, a serial killer isn't someone who just spontaneously kills without ever thinking about it beforehand, like, you know, in a bar thing that escalates. It's someone who's planned this out, who has intentionality and who's thought about it. And I wonder if the jury is going to sort of make a connection between Brian Walsh and that way of going about killing somebody.
I mean, it makes you wonder a little bit. Like, while he was Googling, did it just, you know, kind of come up under suggested search results? And he sees, ooh, trash bag killer. I wonder how he did this. You know, it's a fair question. Prosecutors have two alleged motives here, the $2.7 million in life insurance and the affair with William Fasto. I mean, in your experience, which plays better with a jury, money or betrayal?
Gosh, you can certainly get traction on both here. And you look at, in this case specifically, you look at Brian Walsh and you look at his prior motivations for misdeeds. Those motivations include financial aspects. He's committed fraud before. That shows that he's willing to break the law in order to monetarily enrich himself. And so does that principle apply to this murder where allegedly he broke the law to monetarily enrich himself? You can sort of draw a common thread between those series of actions over time if you're the Commonwealth.
William Fasto is expected to testify. He's the one who had allegedly the affair with Anna. And they're, I mean, prosecution's owning this outright. Like, yeah, she was having an affair. What does the prosecution need from him when he's on the stand? What are the risks of putting the other man on the stand when, in fact, you know, that could be looked at as, well, you know, maybe there was some motive here or maybe or the risk of even garnering sympathy for Brian in some way, shape or form, you know, in the scorned lover department, even though, you know, his wife's dead.
Here, you know, there are some risks and they're not necessarily legal risks as much as they are like optics risks and ways that the jury is going to view the case. Because when that person's on the stand, the cross-examination is going to be something like, hey, you knew the decedent was married, right? And you engaged in a romantic relationship anyway, and you did this romantic act with her, didn't you? And you did this romantic act with her, didn't you? And she didn't seem to have any problem with this, did she? She didn't seem to have a problem with cheating on my client over here, did she? And so you sort of, it's a character assassination of the victim, which is also risky. But some jurors might look at that and say, gosh, you know, perhaps there aren't clean hands on both sides of this. And would that factor into their decision? It could.
But there's a pair of hands that are far dirtier, you know, I mean, like literally dirty with blood. So I'm just trying to picture myself on a jury like that. Like, would I at any point want to just say, yeah, there's not enough evidence here. I don't know.
You know, and Stacey, one thing that comes to mind too is the juror's background. You know, I have no idea, but let's say a juror, there was infidelity with their parents and that ruined their family. And that had a substantial impact on them. And they have sort of resentment build up towards people who do that. Could that somehow sway in favor of the defense? The juror's background and how they view infidelity could be key.
Yeah.
All it takes is one person at the end of the day. Nobody has ever been found in this case. Walk me through how prosecutors are going to prove murder here. Because you have obviously the defendant saying it wasn't murder. Their excuse is asinine. But again, you don't have a body. So I guess anything's possible. I mean, let alone proving first degree murder here without remains, without a cause of death, without a definitive time of death. How do they get there when you do have pushback saying, no, not murder. This is a sudden death, but we can't prove that either.
It's tougher than you think, Tony. You know, we look at a case on paper and we're like, God, this guy looks pretty guilty. But then when you get in that gauntlet of trial, the prosecution has to prove that Brian Walsh murdered her intentionally after deliberation. And without those key elements of a body, cause of death, weapon, those kind of things, it's going to be hard. You know, one thing that I used to do as a prosecutor is use circumstantial evidence. And I would in jury selection, I would say, hey, look, let's say you went to bed before you went to bed at night, there was no snow on the ground. And then you woke up in the morning, there's a bunch of snow on the ground. Couldn't you conclude from that? You can conclude that it was snowing overnight. And that happened. Did you see it snowing overnight? You know, did you measure the precipitation? Did you, you didn't do that, but your common sense leads you to that conclusion. And I think the prosecution will have to argue that circumstantially.
If her body is ever found, regardless of how this case turns out, let's just say he is maybe just, they decide he's not guilty. There's not enough evidence here. What if they find the body? Can he be charged again, or is this a double jeopardy issue?
He probably cannot be charged again in state court. There would be double jeopardy because under the Constitution, double jeopardy, if you are tried of one charge in a particular forum and you're acquitted of it, you can't be tried again because they got more evidence. Now, could there be a possible federal case brought? You know, it would depend on the circumstances, whether they gave rise to federal jurisdiction, but it's not unheard of for someone to be acquitted in one forum, like a state court, and then to be pursued in another forum like federal court. So there's at least a possibility.
Damn.
You know, you made the reference, the analogy, and that's the best one. I love that too. The, you know, if it snows, here's what circumstantial evidence is. It can also work very much in the way of information they have from Anna's recent health rating and her health screening, because insurance, they're looking at being a possibility here. Like we said, there was that about $2.7 million that Brian stood to gain from her death. But with that insurance that they got a couple years ago, Anna had to take a medical test so they could rate her in terms of risk. She came back one, meaning least likely to die. Like, just this is one the insurance company's like, yes, let's insure her. We're likely going to make a lot of money here and probably never have to pay out. So that seems to be another thing that kind of quietly dismantles the sudden death defense as a piece of circumstantial evidence.
Exactly. And you know, in order for the jury to kind of buy this sudden unexplained death theory, now the defense doesn't have a burden to prove it to them, but you're just going to want to say, hey, can I, place faith in this theory? You got to look at the surrounding circumstances. You know, if she had been in and out of hospitals, if she had suffered from long-term condition from which she appeared to recover or something like that, that would be one thing. But if a person is healthy as a horse and then just all of a sudden, you know, people don't spontaneously combust. Like, we're just getting into the realm of things that are a bit too far afield, perhaps, for this jury.
Well, I would say if you watched Unsolved Mysteries in the early 90s, I think some
X-Files.
People did spontaneously combust. You know, I mean, come on.
If
Robert Stack said it, it must have happened. You know, I don't know what happened to those actors, but I saw some scenes where there was just smoke. And it's like, oh, God, they spontaneously. I'm surprised they didn't go down that one. She spontaneously combusted, everyone. Let's go to the 1989 copy of Unsolved Mysteries for our evidence here. The trial of Brian Walsh has some unusual dynamics beyond just the evidence. You got potential witnesses tied to the Michael Proctor scandal from the Karen Reed case. You've got a defendant who was stabbed in jail 2 months ago and just came off a 40-day mental health evaluation. And you've got a jury that has to decide if a man who admits he cut up his wife's body is telling them the truth when he says he didn't kill her. And by the way, I have a lovely Warhol over here if you'd like to buy it. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, is with us talking about all of this as we're trying to break it down as this trial unfolds. A lot of quirks here. One of those, like I said, Michael Proctor, the scandal from the Karen Reed case. Obviously, there's all the issues there. We don't need to go into all of them. But Proctor himself worked the case before he was fired. How much do you expect the defense to lean into something like that? And could it actually move a needle with the jury? And I'd also be wondering, you know, it probably depends how much they know about the Karen Reed trial, too.
You know, I think the defense would be prudent in really exploring those issues because, you know, you have this purported doubt regarding the cause of death. And perhaps the jury's like, I don't know about that. But then you got to add a layer. You add a layer of Trooper Proctor. This guy is a shady dude, and he was working this case. Can you really believe everything that he did in the investigation? You add on top of that, you have this, jailhouse inmate who's going to testify, who was just on a mental health hold. You add all these layers of doubt. It does that cumulative effect of doubt. appear sufficient for the jury to determine, you know, hey, I don't know about this unexplained death. I don't know that Trooper Proctor, you know, screwed everything up. But when we combine all these things, is that enough for reasonable doubt? That's an argument that'll be made.
And you're going for doubt. I mean, when you're going for doubt, having Michael Proctor anywhere in the repertoire is not a great thing. You don't want it. It's not a good look. But even though, I mean, do you feel that the evidence in this case is strong enough to really outshine anything in the Proctor world? I mean, you don't have Proctor in this case on, you know, on tape or on texts, you know, calling him a no ass bitch or something like that. You know, you just have him connected because he's part of a department that's part of a department. So there's not all that. And this doesn't mean everything he touched, you know, turned to absolute shit. But it's going to be a hurdle. They're going to have to take a look out. Walsh was stabbed in jail in September, underwent 40 days of medical competency evaluations, and was just cleared to stand trial literally 2 weeks ago. Does any of that factor into how a jury perceives him, or is that kept away from them entirely?
I think it's doubtful the jury would even find out about that. You know, goings on in jail, unfortunately, it is a gnarly place, and it can be dangerous, and people get hurt. And his defense might try to offer it because they might want to garner some sympathy and saying, God, this guy was stabbed up and he's been through hell. But I'm not sure the judge is going to let that in. I don't see how it's really relevant to any of the charges. And so, kind of too bad for Brian Walsh, but I don't think it's going to do him any favors at trial.
Yeah. The judge indicated that she's going to have to instruct the jury on consciousness of guilt evidence. Can you explain what that means and how it applies here?
Certainly. So, if you think about a DUI case, in Colorado where I practice, if you're pulled over for DUI, they go through tests and then they can ask you, hey, do you want to take a chemical test like a breathalyzer or a blood test? Because that will show the blood alcohol content in your body. And then if a person refuses that, the argument from the prosecution is like, hey, look, if this person had nothing to hide, if they were actually sober, of course they would just blow into this thing. Of course they would, take a blood test or whatever. The fact that they didn't shows they're concealing something because they know what they've done is unlawful. And that same principle will apply to Brian Walsh's case in terms of the deceptive conduct with the police officers and also the cover-up. Why cover something up if you didn't do anything to cause it? That'll be how the prosecution styles.
No, makes some sense. Stacey, did you have something?
I know we have to do due process here. This guy is entitled to a trial, but I want to bang my head on the desk. Like, it just to me seems like such an open and shut case here. I feel like we're wasting everybody's time.
A lot of trials feel like that, though.
I know they do. So thank you for letting me vent that. But I just over and over, I keep saying, how is this guy not guilty?
Yeah, I keep looking at you and everything. You get kind of look in this face like, yeah, but come on. It's kind of like what I'm seeing. He's been in custody since January of 2023. He's also serving a federal sentence for art fraud. Let's just roll the dice here and say, you know, he gets a Yahtzee and he's acquitted of murder. What happens? I mean, obviously, he's admitted guilt to the other two charges. I'm assuming he doesn't just walk here. I'm assuming he's locked up for some amount of time. Would he not be?
Tony, I looked a few weeks back at the charges and including the obstruction charge to which you pled guilty, the disposing of a body charge, and those charges do carry potentially years in prison. And so, you know, especially if he's acquitted, sometimes judges they have their own opinion about what happened. And if they think the jury might have got it wrong on that one charge, you know, they might add a little extra onto the sentence for the other convictions. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be surprised if that kind of thing happens here. He spends years in prison. He's got the fraud prison sentence as well. But it wouldn't be an eternity. It wouldn't be a lifetime thing, at least on the obstruction and disposing of a body charge. I think the maximum is 10 years on the most serious of those charges. And with good time and earned time, that's not a lifetime.
That's just, I mean, it is what it is, but that's always amazing to me. Like the horrible things people can do. And like, well, that's kind of a slap on the wrist, like concealing a body chop. Like you can literally 10 years or less for going to Lowe's, getting the hacksaw, cutting the body up. And like, that's all there is. That really, I mean, yeah.
There are people who are serving years, multiple years for just using marijuana for themselves. They weren't even selling it. They're just in jail. And when you put it over this template of what this guy could be serving, it just, it doesn't feel fair. Sometimes the justice system just doesn't feel fair, you know?
Yeah, certainly. And I think last time I checked, the obstruction charge actually carries more potential prison than disposing of a body. So that's sort of like a weird value judgment that the legislature made there, which is kind of a head scratch.
What about disposing of a body while on marijuana?
There you go.
I think you'd almost need it. I don't know how else you really handle that. I don't know. Maybe a lot of booze, but then you're going to crash your car. And yeah, the defense has not shown its full hand yet in what experts are going to be calling. If you're running the defense here, what kind of expert testimony would you be looking for to create reasonable doubt for Brian Walsh?
Gosh, if you've got a solid forensic pathologist on the defense, you know, the prosecution uses forensic pathologists that they opine on cause of death and manner of death. And it's going to depend in part on how that expert presents to the jury. Do they seem credible? Do they seem qualified? What's their experience? What's their experience with the specific alleged condition of sudden unexplained death? It appears extremely rare, according to defense's opening argument. So, can the defense really get up there and say, hey, there's a track record of this. There's a medical science foundation for this. And will the jury believe that? You got to have a good expert. And so I think we'll kind of be sitting at the edge of our seats to see how that plays out.
Can we rewind for just a second and go back to his competency to stand trial and to his 40-day psych eval? What goes on in something like that? Is this something that they could go back to and say, see, he does have mental breaks every now and then. This was a panic moment. Would they play into that and lean into that? And can you tell us how they evaluate somebody like that?
Yeah. So typically what happens, at least in Colorado where I practice, is when a person's incarcerated, they have a mental health professional go there. They do a pretty involved assessment. They do an interview. They do they acquire information about the individual's background, their track history, criminal record, things like that, that they conduct a number of tests and psychological tests, things like that. And they opine on, hey, can this person be competent to stand trial or not? The risk with defense, if they were to bring that up, I think what that does is it might open the door to everything that came out during that assessment and during the rehabilitation period where they're trying to get the guy competent through therapy and pharmaceuticals and everything like that. And perhaps during that period, there could be some gnarly information that is disclosed. And usually it is just rife with potential pitfalls if you open the door to that, because then, you know, maybe you can act that you can argue that he's snapped, but also the jury gets to hear about some perhaps very unsavory and distasteful stuff that this guy has said and done, and that's a big risk.
Even more so than what he's on trial for.
Perhaps.
How much do you think the defense is going to play into heartstrings on this? And this is a hard one to play heartstrings on when your instrument is literally just a piece of shit. You know, I mean, and you have this going, look at this guy. He chopped up his wife. He's been dealing in art fraud. But the heartstrings would be the three kids. Their mom is gone. And now you're going to take away their father.
I don't know how you can land that one, though, with this guy. I mean, in some cases, sure. You're like, look, he's a really love. This guy, it's like he's out, you know, chopping up his mom in the other room and getting the kids Happy Meals in the other. It's not exactly the shining portrait of father of the year.
Oh, certainly not. And in fact, you have to argue that rather artfully, because in most jurisdictions, you can't say if you convict this guy, he's going to prison forever. This is his consequence. That'll be his sentence. Don't do that to his family. You can't talk about the consequence. You can't talk about the sentence. But you can talk about, you know, you can style it as like, hey, if this person is branded with the scarlet letter of a murder conviction, we all know what that means. And what that means is it's going to have grave impacts for his life and for the people in his life. So you kind of have to dance around it as opposed to directly saying, hey, don't send this guy to prison forever because these kids won't have a dad. And then on top of that, the circumstances of this one are pretty grisly. Tough argument.
And that's got to be a hard one, too, because you don't know what every juror is going to run it through their own prism. And some jurors are going to be thinking like I do, where it's like, yeah, the best thing for these children is to never interact with their father again for the rest of their lives. That is the best possible outcome in this horrible situation. But you're going to have others that are going to have a different prism of, yeah, my parents are a piece of shit, but I've continued to have an interaction with them throughout my life because I'm feel guilty or whatever reason compels them to stay in an abusive relationship with a shitty parent. And they're going to think, oh, it's still good. You still need that biological parent right there or whatever. They're going to make that argument because, you know, this is how our court system even still works in family law of, you know, let's reunify pieces of shit with innocent people, innocent children. So you still have that thinking. And it seems to be fairly divided out there, I would say. I mean, in my opinion, of people who are going to think one way versus another. So that's another prism that they got to consider if they're going to go down that road at all, is it not?
Exactly. And what you're touching on, Tony, I think is so important because nowhere in the statutes does it say the jury can consider whether these children are not going to have any parents after this. But what it illustrates is that we all come into this with our own life experience as jurors. Mm-hmm. And that life experience colors the way that we see circumstances, the way that we make determinations about what should happen. And so even though it's not contained in the jury instructions, you're not going to find it in some statute book, you better believe that background of that person substantially influences how they might act as a juror in a case like this.
Yeah. So many pieces at play and so many prisms to go through to figure out how to get from point A to point B if you're the defense or you're the prosecution, and obviously both landing in very different holes. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, thank you so much as always for coming on and giving us your insight into this case as always. And if you want to express your opinion on this, let us know in the comment section on YouTube. Go to the website, go to our YouTube channel, Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi, and you will find us there, and you can weigh in on those comments and press subscribe while you are at it. Until next time, for Eric, Todd, and Stacey, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue. The $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and four-piece McNuggets.
It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.
Running a Shopify store and drowning in shipping chaos? ShipStation can fix this for you. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels with advanced automation, batch processing, and shipping discounts that a single platform just doesn't offer. Like discounts up to 90% off major carriers. See how ShipStation can make shipping for your Shopify store better. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com.
Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue. The $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and four-piece McNuggets.
It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.
If you run a Shopify store, listen up. Shopify has got you covered for selling, but when your shipping volume grows and you're juggling multiple plugins just to get orders out the door, you need tools that can keep up. Stop duct taping your shipping workflow and use the tools that work better together, like Shopify and ShipStation. Think of ShipStation as Shopify's dedicated shipping partner. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels to save you time and money by automating the entire order fulfillment process, from syncing your orders all the way through inventory management and returns. Automate the rate browser to select the lowest rates on shipments, with discounts up to 90% off major carriers like USPS, UPS, and FedEx. No wonder businesses that use ShipStation grow 3 times faster on average and ship 15 times more orders. See how ShipStation can help you scale and boost your Shopify sales. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com.
Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue. The $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and 4-piece McNuggets. It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.
If you run a Shopify store, listen up. Shopify has got you covered for selling, but when your shipping volume grows and you're juggling multiple plugins just to get orders out the door, you need tools that can keep up. Stop duct taping your shipping workflow and use the tools that work better together, like Shopify and ShipStation. Think of ShipStation as Shopify's dedicated shipping partner. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels to save you time and money by automating the entire order fulfillment process, from syncing your orders all the way through inventory management and returns. Automate the rate browser to select the lowest rates on shipments, with discounts up to 90% off major carriers like USPS, UPS, and FedEx. No wonder businesses that use ShipStation grow 3 times faster on average and ship 15 times more orders. See how ShipStation can help you scale and boost your Shopify sales. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com.
Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue. The $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and 4-piece McNuggets. It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.
If you run a Shopify store, listen up. Shopify has got you covered for selling, but when your shipping volume grows and you're juggling multiple plugins just to get orders out the door, you need tools that can keep up. Stop duct taping your shipping workflow and use the tools that work better together, like Shopify and ShipStation. Think of ShipStation as Shopify's dedicated shipping partner. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels to save you time and money by automating the entire order fulfillment process, from syncing your orders all the way through inventory management and returns. Automate the rate browser to select the lowest rates on shipments, with discounts up to 90% off major carriers like USPS, UPS, and FedEx. No wonder businesses that use ShipStation grow 3 times faster on average and ship 15 times more orders. See how ShipStation can help you scale and boost your Shopify sales. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com.
Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue. The $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and 4-piece McNuggets. It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.
Running a Shopify store and drowning in shipping chaos? ShipStation can fix this for you. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels with advanced automation, batch processing, and shipping discounts that a single platform just doesn't offer. Like discounts up to 90% off major carriers. See how ShipStation can make shipping for your Shopify store better. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com.
Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue. The $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and 4-piece McNuggets. It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.
If you run a Shopify store, listen up. Shopify has got you covered for selling, but when your shipping volume grows and you're juggling multiple plugins just to get orders out the door, you need tools that can keep up. Stop duct taping your shipping workflow and use the tools that work better together, like Shopify and ShipStation. Think of ShipStation as Shopify's dedicated shipping partner. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels to save you time and money by automating the entire order fulfillment process. From syncing your orders all the way through inventory management and returns. Automate the rate browser to select the lowest rates on shipments with discounts up to 90% off major carriers like USPS, UPS, and FedEx. No wonder businesses that use ShipStation grow 3 times faster on average and ship 15 times more orders. See how ShipStation can help you scale and boost your Shopify sales. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com.
Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue. The $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and 4-piece McNuggets. It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.
Apartment People, champion, the trusted name in Columbus Living, brings you The District of Berkshire.
Man, it will be fun to live there, right by Tanger Outlet Malls. Oh my God, great location too, getting to and from Columbus, and a great deal right now.
Free rent until next year. Free rent until next year.
He ain't lying. Move in now, you don't pay rent until next year.
The District at Berkshire, available now at livewithchampion.com. That's livewithchampion.com. That's livewithchampion.com.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.